Someone changed my title a little bit, actually, so the topological phases of matter, interesting and useful. Now, I think, unfortunately, a lot of things I'm going to say might sound familiar to a lot of people in the audience. If you're a string theorist, you're going to discover that this field, a lot of it is based on string theory that was started in the things that string theorists were thinking about starting in the 1980s. And if you're not a string theorist, but you happen to live in Santa Barbara, this might sound familiar because Microsoft has built Station Q right across the road, where they have a bunch of very good physicists and mathematicians thinking about topological phases of matter and why they're interesting and useful. So I apologize if people are hearing things that they've already heard. But I'm going to try to tell the story a little bit differently, and I'm going to gauge my success if every single person in the room learns at least one new thing by the end of the talk. So I'm going to start with a little bit of a historical introduction, way back with Lord Kelvin, 1867. Everyone probably knows Lord Kelvin, but probably people mostly don't know his friend, Peter Tate. Does anyone know who Peter Tate was? Okay, a couple people, but everyone else is learning something new. So Peter Tate was a very good physicist himself. Did you know he was a golfer? He's actually a very talented golfer. He taught his son to golf, and his son played third in the British Open. There's a Tate Cup that you can win if you're... Anyway, so now you learn something new, too. So there's an apocryphal story about Peter Tate that he was watching someone smoking a cigarette one day. And he, you know, if you're a talented smoker, you can blow smoke rings. And he was watching these smoke rings, and it was sort of early in the development of fluid dynamics. And people were just starting to understand vortices and vortex strings. And so, a smoke ring, it's sort of a circle, and the fluid flows around the circle this way. And he thought to himself, well, maybe I can build a machine that will blow smoke rings. So he set it to work doing this, and if you like, there's actually instructions for building, smoke ring machines, which he called his vortex device. And it's actually quite an impressive thing if you want to build one and see how it works. And he showed it to Lord Kelvin, and Lord Kelvin was also very impressed. The first thing he noticed, first of all, you can make huge smoke rings, a meter across, very easily. And these things can travel 40 yards without dissipating. They're really quite surprising. And Kelvin was rather amazed by this. Also, as they travel along, they can vibrate a little bit. And sometimes if you aim two of them at each other, you can get a configuration where the two vortex rings actually link with each other. So Kelvin started thinking about this. He actually, so he thought, well, okay, so they're stable. And he later actually proved the theorem about stability of vortices in ideal fluid. And at the time, we didn't have any ideal fluids. Later on in life, we have superconductors and superfluids, which are sort of ideal fluids. But at the time, they didn't have any. But they thought there existed one. They thought there existed this thing called ether, and we're all swimming in this ether, and you couldn't see it, and you couldn't feel it, but it allowed light to propagate. So he started thinking, well, maybe I can make these smoke rings in the ether. And what would these things look like? At the same time, he was thinking about another problem that was sort of fundamental to science at the time, and the problem was, why is it that we have hydrogen and helium and nothing in between? What causes the periodic table to be discrete? So he thought to himself, this rather brilliant idea, that maybe a vortex loop in the ether, in the fluid of the ether, maybe that's hydrogen. And maybe this configuration of vortex loops, maybe that's a hydrogen molecule. And maybe if you had some more complicated loop in the ether, like this, maybe that's helium, and so forth. So this is known as the vortex model of the atom. Now, at the time it was very popular, it seemed like a great idea. It sort of explained why it is atoms are discrete. But after about 15 years of study, people threw the idea away because it had nothing to do with atoms, as we now know. And we also know there's no such thing as ether. But it had its proponents, and one of the biggest proponents of this idea was Peter Tate. So Peter Tate spent actually the remainder of his life, more or less, thinking, besides golfing, he spent the remainder of his life thinking about knots So, you know, what he wanted to do is he wanted to build the periodic table by looking at the different possible knots you can make in vortices and ethers. So this is the first one, this is the second one, that you have more complicated and more complicated knots corresponding to all the different elements. So Tate is sort of rightfully viewed by a lot of mathematicians as being one of the real fathers of the mathematical theory of knots, which has been a very rich branch of mathematics over the last 150 years. Now, during his exploration of the theory of knots, Peter Tate hit on what is still considered perhaps the fundamental question of knot theory. And that's, how do you know if two knots, you know, if they're drawn on a sheet of paper or you have them in strings in your hand, how do you know if they're topologically equivalent or if they're actually different knots? So for example, if I draw something that looks like this, it looks different from this, but we know that it's just been folded over and it's really topologically the same. So there shouldn't be two elements on the periodic table. There should only be one, because this thing can be continuously deformed into that thing without cutting any of the strands. Now this sounds like, in this particular case, it seems like a trivial problem to see that this thing and this thing are the same, but if they were really complicated knots, it's not so easy to tell if they're the same or the not, or if they're different. So it's still actually something that's considered to be a rather hard problem, distinguishing when knots are the same and when they're not. So I advertise this thing as a physics talk, but I'm going to take a short detour into the mathematical theory of knots here for a moment. But I promise I'm going to come back to physics soon enough. So mathematicians have been working on this problem for 150 years, and it's still considered difficult, but they have some tools that really help out in distinguishing knots from each other. And one of the best tools they have is the idea of a knot invariant. And a knot invariant is basically a mapping from a knot or a picture of a knot drawn on a sheet of paper to some output via some set of rules or an algorithm. So you put in the picture of the knot and you get something out. And the rules are cooked up in such a way that topologically equivalent knots have to give the same output, even if they're drawn differently, like this thing and this thing. So if you have two knots and you evaluate their knot invariant, some particular knot invariant, it comes up different, you know immediately that those two things are topologically inequivalent, meaning one cannot be deformed into the other without cutting strands. Actually, I should just comment for a moment here that I'm going to be sloppy about my nomenclature. A mathematician would call this thing a link rather than a knot because it's two strands, whereas this thing is a knot because it's one strand. I'm not a mathematician, so I'm not going to make that distinction, but just to be a little bit honest for the mathematicians in the audience. So the idea of a knot invariant, it can tell you when two knots are different, but sometimes you have two different knots that give you the same output. So it actually turns out to be probably the most important question in the mathematical theory of knots right now, whether you can find a knot invariant that can distinguish all possible knots from each other. So, if you want to make a big bang in the mathematical theory of knots, go try to prove that. So just as an example, I'm going to show you an example of a knot invariant that's particularly useful for us. And this is known as a Kaufman, sometimes called a Kaufman bracket or Kaufman invariant. It's very closely related to the Jones polynomial that some of you have probably undoubtedly heard of. So the Kaufman invariant has only two simple rules. The first rule is if you ever see an overcrossing of strings like this, you can replace it by a coefficient A times something where the strings don't cross in this way, plus A inverse times something where the strings don't cross in this way. I'm going to take the same rule and just redraw it by rotating all of the strings 90 degrees. This is exactly the same rule, it's just convenient to write it twice. Same rule, just rotate 90 degrees. So this is the first rule.
Inverse,
thank you. The second rule is that if you have an open loop ever, you can replace it by minus a squared minus a minus 2, which is usually called d. And that's all there is to it. So let's see how this rule actually works by applying it to this. So in this picture here, you have this overcrossing in there. You see two strings crossing each other. It looks exactly like this. So we'll just replace what's inside that dotted circle by A times something where it goes like this, plus A inverse times something where it goes like this, And then we have to fill in the rest of not exactly as it's filled in over here. So it goes like this up here, and then down here it goes like this. Okay. And then we have a couple crossings over here. This crossing here and here looks just like this picture here. So I can replace it by, okay, so now there's an A outside from up here. And then I have another factor of A. And this thing is going to look like this, plus A inverse times something that looks like this, plus this factor is A inverse times something that looks like this, A times something that looks like this, plus A inverse times something that looks like this. Okay, is everyone sort of clear on what I'm doing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Okay, now I'm left with just a bunch of open loops. Each time I see an open loop, I replace it by D. So here I have A squared times D squared plus B plus D cubed plus A to the minus 2 D squared. And we notice that, well, okay. So A squared plus A minus 2 is actually defined to be minus D. So this term are going to cancel this term and they're left with D. Okay? So that's not surprising that you get this output because we know that this thing is really just an open loop and the open loop is defined to have an output D. So because these two things are topologically equivalent, we can turn this thing into this thing without cutting any strands. The knot invariant gives us the same output. Okay, see how that works? Okay, to the purist, this is an invariant of regular isotopy. I'll explain what that means later if someone presses me. Okay, so why am I telling you all of this? This is all knot theory. The reason I'm telling you this is because it's very closely related to the idea of a topological quantum field theory. So topological quantum field theory can be roughly defined as a quantum system or a quantum field theory where all amplitudes depend only on the topology of a process and not on the detailed geometry. So to be more clear about exactly what I mean by that statement, amplitudes depend on topology, not geometry, we have to go back and remember what Feynman taught us about quantum mechanics. Feynman tells us that if you want to figure out the partition function of a quantum system, or the propagator, or just what's the amplitude of getting from some initial configuration to some final configuration, you have to sum over all possible things that happen in between, all possible paths or space-time configurations between the beginning and the end. So what you're summing is a sum over all paths of e to the I action of that. Of a particular configuration. So let me draw an example here. And incidentally, throughout the talk, I'm always going to be talking about two-dimensional systems and time in the third direction. So time is going up this way. So here's a two-dimensional system, a disk. And some space-time process that is going to have to contribute to the partition function of the propagator is a process where, say, at this point in time here, there's a particle hole creation event. So now I'm drawing the world lines of these particles. So here is, you know, pair creation. And then maybe over here there's another pair creation event. This, maybe this particle wraps around this particle in some way. And they come back together and at some later time maybe annihilate. Like that. So this is a space-time process drawn in 2 + 1 dimensions of something that can happen and has to be added to the path integral. Now, in a topological quantum field theory, now I'm going to draw exactly the same. Here's the two-dimensional system. This process and this process are topologically identical, so the amplitude for this thing happening and the amplitude for this thing happening have to be the same. That's what defines the theory as being topological. The amplitudes don't depend on the details of what you drew, but just on the topology of what you drew. Okay? Everyone still with me? Okay. So what should be clear now, or clear after you think about it for a little bit, is that what that means is that this quantity here, the amplitude that gets added up, has to be a knot invariant, because it's a mapping from a knot this knot here to an amplitude, which is the output. And the amplitude and the rules are cooked up in such a way that the output, the amplitude, depends only on the topology of the process and not on the details of the geometry. So that's making a connection between, you know, space-time integrals over here, path integrals, and knot invariants. So this is, you know, what Witten won his field medal for, more or less. And what he actually did was a little more than this. He actually showed what type of quantum field theories that were already known, correspond to what type of knot invariants. So in particular, he showed one thing that, well, essentially showed that quantum field theories of type SU2 level K, now if you don't know what that means, maybe I'll say a couple words about it later, but don't worry about it. It's a name for a particular type of topological quantum field theory that we study. Correspond to the Kaufman invariant with the coefficient A put in, where A equals I times e to the I pi over 2 times k plus 2. Or equivalently, this parameter D is 2 cosine pi over k plus 2. Okay. So, and in fact, Witten's Fields Medal was awarded to him and also to von Jones at the same time for developing these knot invariants. Okay, so finally, after all of this, I can explain what the title of my talk means, topological phases of matter. So a topological phase of matter is nothing more than a phase of matter, an actual system, a condensed matter system, whose low-energy long-wavelength theory is a topological quantum field theory. So the effective theory of the system has these properties that amplitudes depend only on topology and not on the detailed geometry. Now, what's rather surprising is that these things aren't just a figment of Ed Witten's imagination. We actually now believe that they really exist. And you know, people have come up with all various model systems in which they could exist, but there are a few systems in which we think there's a fighting chance that they really already do exist and they've been created. So I'm going to make a list. So there's topological quantum field theories of type SU2 level 2. And there's sort of a list of things that are proposed that this particular topological quantum field theory, or the Kaufman invariant with this particular parameter inserting k equals 2, is actually occurs in some real physical systems. So the primary example is what's known as the nu equals 5 halves fractional quantum Hall state, or the Moore Reed state sometimes. Also, there's a proposal, strontium-ruthenate, superconducting films. This is just some fancy superconductor. It has to be two-dimensional. So everything I'm talking about is two-dimensional, so you make it into a thin film. Another one is helium-3A superfluid film. And then there's also SU2 level 3, which is supposed to correspond to U equals 12/5 fractional quantum Hall state. And I'll say a couple of words about these things in a moment. Now, there's other possibilities that are proposed that you could create systems artificially to make them be topological phases of matter, and things like Josephson junction arrays, various fancy spin systems, cold atoms, and so forth. But these are the ones that people have actually observed in nature out there, where there's reason to believe that they might actually have these properties. Now, what's the evidence for this at this point? Not so good. That's not to say it's not true, it's just very hard to tell for sure. It's very hard to do experiments on these things, and there's a lot of complications, but if you were to take a bet, especially on this guy here, which is the strongest candidate right now, if you were to take a bet, you wouldn't want to bet your life on it, but you'd be unwise to bet against it either. All right. So, for honesty of advertising, before going on, and I'm going to explain a little bit about the fractional quantum Hall physics in a moment, but I want to actually mention something just to be completely honest here, because if people go home with these rules, you're going to be very upset with me. So I'll tell you why you're going to be very upset with me. Let's imagine a knot like this. This will also explain to you what the difference between the Kaufman inversion and the polynomial is. So let's take a knot here. So this is extending off to some other knot that closes up, and then it's just a little piece of a knot here. And let's try to evaluate its Kaufman invariant. So it has this overcrossing here, so I can replace it by A times something that sort of does this, plus A inverse times something that does this. And then this guy gets replaced by D, so it's AD plus A inverse times a straight line, because this thing can be just straightened out into a straight line. You put these two together, plug in that, get some algebra, and you get minus A cubed times a straight line, extending off. Okay? And at this point, you should be really upset, because I told you that the knot invariants depend only on the topology and not on the detailed geometry, and it's very clear that I can just straighten this guy out by pulling it tight and get this, and yet their Kaufman invariants differ by a factor of minus A cubed. So what's going on? Well, what we have to do is we have to think about our quantum particles as having a little bit of width. So let's give it a little bit of width here. Oops. Like that. Give it a little bit of width here. And then if you try to straighten this thing out, if you'll know what I mean if you ever try to straighten the garden hose, you know, twist it up, you actually get this thing twisting around each other when you try to straighten a loop like this. Okay? Is that something that's clear to people? Okay. So in fact, this factor of minus A cubed, which is conveniently just a complex phase, is accounting for the fact that the particle is rotating around itself when you straighten this out. Now, remember from quantum mechanics that rotating a particle with spin introduces a quantum mechanical phase, and this is exactly the phase that's been introduced. So the Kaufman invariant has gotten this physics correctly automatically, even though these things look like they're topologically identical, they're not. Now, the Jones polynomial was cooked up such that this and this, it's a modification of Kaufman if you want to think of it that way, such that this and this would have the same Jones polynomial. You're basically just removing this spin factor from the Jones polynomial, so you have something that doesn't care about introducing this little twist. But for the physical system that we're concerned with, we actually need to keep track of the particle spin, so we actually use the Kaufman invariant. All right. So let me now move on and discuss these physical systems a little bit. I'm going to focus on quantum Hall effect because that's the case where the evidence is best that these things really are topological phases of matter or really are topological quantum field theories or have these particular properties. So what is, actually, I don't need this thing. Can I get it? So to ask, what is fractional quantum Hall effect? Well, it's not that complicated. It's basically just two-dimensional electrons interacting with each other via the usual Coulomb interaction. And how do you make them two-dimensional? Well, a trick known to experimentalists, you trap them between semiconductor layers. Very easy to do. And then you add a magnetic field perpendicular to the plane of the sample. Now, when you take a system like this and you cool it down, you get out fractional quantum Hall effect, which means that the system becomes completely dissipationless, kind of like a superfluid or a superconductor. Now, as you vary the magnetic field, there are many different fractional quantum Hall effect states of matter that you can observe. And they're indexed by what's known as the filling fraction. It's a index mu, which just basically tells you the ratio of the number of electrons, the density of electrons, to the density of flux quanta. So it's something that you can vary experimentally if you like. At near certain values of nu, numbers like 1/3, 2/5, these numbers here, 5/8, 12/5, you see the system become dissipationless, and that's the sign of the fractional quantum Hall effect. I'm going to claim that these things are topological quantum field theories, generally. Although it turns out that most of these are kind of boring topological quantum field theories, and I'll explain why in a moment, and these two are the less boring ones. So actually, something that's you know, experimentalists are very familiar with these fractional quantum Hall systems is sort of already a sign that these things have topological properties. So take a sample. It's a two-dimensional sample, but it can have any crazy shape you like. And then attach contacts to it. Apply a voltage to the contacts. And, generally, if you apply a current and you measure the voltage. well, it doesn't matter in this case in a fractional quantum Hall, effect, where you attach the voltage leads or the current leads or the shape of the sample, you always measure the same voltage. You always measure zero. That's not too surprising. You know, it's like a superconductor. You measure zero. But now I'm going to change the experiment a little bit and cross the voltage and current leads. This, so this guy attaches here. This guy attaches here. And you measure, independent of where you put the voltage leads, as long as they're crossed, remember, when I cross the voltage leads, I change the topology. As long as they're crossed, I will measure the same finite voltage. And the finite voltage is just related to the current and the filling fraction. So that's already a sign that there's some sort of topological invariance in these systems, because it doesn't matter the details of the system, just the topology of what you did. Another comment about these systems. In high energy physics, we have this paradigm of there being somewhere out there some grand unified theory with very high symmetry. And you come down to low energy, and the symmetry breaks. You have a less symmetric theory. This is actually quite the opposite. The high energy theory is two-dimensional electrons in a magnetic field. The low energy theory is more symmetric. It's emerged as you went to low temperature or low energy. You get this topological quantum field theory, which has this symmetry under all sorts of smooth deformations of space-time. You can, you know, change the shape of the sample. You can move things around. It doesn't matter exactly what the particles did, as long as they had the same as long as the process has the same topology. This is an incredibly symmetric theory. This is not incredibly symmetric. So the symmetry has emerged at low energy. The final comment I want to make about this is, you know, what is the evidence that these fractional quantum Hall states really are these topological quantum field theories from a theoretical perspective? I mean, no one argues that, you know, when you see in an experiment these fractional quantum Hall states, it's very clear that they're there, but you have to figure out what the properties are, and it's sometimes not so easy to do so experimentally. What we'd like to do is we'd like to start with this theory here. And as the physicist says, we'd like to integrate out high energy degrees of freedom and be left with a low energy theory. So somehow systematically get rid of the high energy parts and be left with the low energy topological quantum field theory. Unfortunately, there's not really any way we know of to do this, or in at least no honest way to we know of. There's some slightly dishonest ways to do it. But you know, if you're a good theorist, you can figure out how to get to what you want, right? But there's no really systematic way to do it. So what people do is they actually start with numerics. This is what Laughlin did ages ago, won his Nobel Prize for. You start with numerics, and then you compare the numerics to trial wave functions. And if the overlap of your trial wave functions with the result of the numerics is 99.9%, you know you have the right answer, more or less. Then the trial wave functions get related to correlators of conformal field theories, and the conformal field theories get related to the topological quantum field theories. So this is sort of a long chain of reasoning. Well, I'm not going to explain much more about it, but the links on the chain are actually getting to be rather solid, so you'd be unwise to bet against them. All right. So let me say a couple more words about some general properties, useful properties, of these topological quantum field theories. Probably the most useful property of these things is, incidentally, you know, if you have questions, you can yell, but not too loud. Okay. So here's my two-dimensional system. A general property of these topological quantum field theories is that if you have particle hole defects in them, quasi-particle, quasi-hole defects, like this, in the system, there's a ground state degeneracy. In other words, there are several states with the particles in exactly the same positions with exactly the same energy. To see why that should be, we'll draw time in the vertical direction again. I'm going to draw two copies of exactly the same picture. So these are supposed to be identical pictures. So even though at this slice in time they look identical, it could be that if you look at the space-time history, the particles were created in different ways, like this. Okay? So this one, these two particles are pulled apart from each other as a pair, and these two are pulled apart as a pair. Or I could have done it in the opposite order, like that. Okay, so let's call this one state 1. And we'll call this one state 2. Okay. Now, I'm going to claim that 1 and 2 are different, but to check that they're different, I have to start taking overlaps or matrix elements between them. So these are the ket states, and I have to come up with the corresponding bra states, which is easy to do. You just take the time reverse of them. So I'm going to draw the same picture again. And I'm going to time reverse them and return them to the vacuum exactly the same way that I took them out. So this is the bra corresponding to 1, and the bra corresponding to 2 is exactly the opposite. Okay. Like that. Okay. Now to take matrix elements. Question?
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. Wouldn't you have infinitely many states with them being created and then?
Yes, you would. Yes, you certainly could. I can make many of them. It's going to turn out only 2 of them are linearly independent, but I'm not going to show you that. But yes, so I could make. Yeah, good point. So to take inner products, all you do is you bring these things together, and you form a knot. So for example, if I want to know the inner product of 1 on 1. I just take this, squeeze it together with that. So here's the picture again. And it was created this way, and was brought back to the vacuum this way. That's 2 open loops. I apply my coupling rules, it gives me d squared. Okay? I can also take 2 on 2 the same way, like this. Well, you can do this in your head. And it came like this, and like this. There's 2 loops. Again, it gives you d squared. Okay? But if I take 1 on 2, so this is on the top, it looks like this, where on the bottom, it looks like this, and this is only a single loop, so that gives you d. All right? So everyone still with me? Anyone not puzzled? Okay. All right. So since it's very clear then, if 1 on 1 is d squared, 2 on 2 is d squared, and 1 on 2 is d, these are 2 linearly independent objects. So they can't be the same, unless d is 1. And in fact, d does happen to be equal to 1 in the k equals 1 case, SU2 level 1. And that's the boring case. And it turns out that most quantum Hall states, that there's maybe 80 quantum Hall states that have been discovered, starting with 1/3, 2/3, 3/5, 2/5. I mean, they just go on and on and on. There are tons and tons of them. And almost all of them look more like this. That in that case, there's no degeneracy of states. There's only a single state, but they're all identical no matter what you did. And that's rather upsetting. But these guys appear to be the exception, not the rule. Please don't ask me why these 2 are special, but it seems to be the case. One more comment, that as you said, I could start doing complicated braid. If I do so, say between the top and the bottom, I can do some funny braid like this, like this one over here, this one here, maybe this one goes around like this, comes back like that. So now I can start considering 2 braid. 2 equals, and if I want to know what that thing equals, I just evaluate the Kaufman invariant again. And what you find is that the action of taking these particles around each other in space-time, actually dragging them around each other, physically makes manipulation on the space of the space of possible ground states. Now, one has to actually go work through and discover that there's going to only be 2 states in this space, and the others are all linearly dependent on those. But that turns out to be the result. Okay. So now, why is this? I promised you this was not going to be, I hope you found it interesting, but why is it going to be useful? Well, had I called these 2 states, instead of calling them 1 and 2, if I had called them 0 and 1, everyone would have said, aha, it's a qubit, right? It's a 2-state system. So, see, that's the difference that adding 1 makes. Okay. And it turns out that it's actually, someone once said that any idiot with a 2-state system thinks they have a quantum computer. but it turns out that there's actually, the idea of doing this, of using these kind of multi-state systems for a quantum computer, it was sort of first proposed by people like Mike Friedman and Alexei Kateyev, and it's really taken off and become very interesting. This is what Microsoft is spending all of their time and money thinking about. But there's actually good reason to believe that it would actually be an intelligent way to build a quantum computer. So the scheme generally would be, you know, you have a big system here, and you're going to start pulling out these two-state systems out of the vacuum, just like we did before. So each set of four of these might be a qubit. Okay, so I have a bunch of qubits there. And then I'm going to do some crazy braid on these in order to manipulate that space of states. So, you know, whatever this crazy braid is. And that manipulation, that braid, is doing some sort of unitary operation on the space of states. And quantum computation is nothing but doing unitary operations on a space of states. So at the end of the day, you can then measure the states by trying to return them to the vacuum, the same way you did before. And the readout is that some of the particles will return to the vacuum, but some of them won't. At least that's one way of measuring them. And so this type of quantum computation scheme, set up your qubits, do an operation on the qubits, measure the qubits, turns out, at least if you pick the right topological quantum field theory, turns out to be just as powerful as any other quantum computer you might build. Now, why is it that this is actually a good idea? I mean, this sounds like an incredibly hard way to do quantum computation, which is already an incredibly hard thing to do. Well, the reason that people like this idea is because it has a really nice immunity to noise. So why is that? So everyone who knows anything about quantum computation knows that the big problem is keeping the system isolated from noise. Any amount of interaction with the environment or coupling to noise is going to ruin everything. So why are things better in this case? Well, so here I drew some complicated braid, and suppose that halfway through the computation, there's, you know, a photon comes in or something like that and creates some noise near this particle. What's going to happen? Well, this particle is going to wiggle instead of moving straight. Okay, the particle wiggles instead of moving straight. Well, in an unusual quantum computer, that ruins everything. It created decoherence and noise, and you're dead. But in this case, as long as you don't change the topology of the braid, you haven't changed anything. The only thing that matters at the end of the day is that you made the right braid. Okay? So it's immune from all sorts of small noise. And the only thing that can kill you is if you get hit by something so big that it kicks you off and makes you wrap around a whole bunch of quasiparticles and come back. Which, you know, if you keep the quasiparticles far apart from each other and everything cold, it's something that you can suppress pretty easily. So that's the general idea of why these things are not only interesting, but also useful. Okay, so in the last couple years, there have been a bunch of experimental groups going out and trying to convince ourselves that this idea of topological quantum field theories is not just a figment of our imagination. We have right now no really great evidence that this thing really is SU2 level 2, this thing really is SU2 level 3, although there's circumstantial evidence. So I'm going to explain now, in the last 15 minutes of the talk, I may even end early, which means I've been talking too fast, what the experiment is that people are trying to do. So first I have to teach you a little bit about quantum Hall physics, which isn't too complicated. So here's a quantum Hall sample. We're looking down on the two-dimensional sample here. So the electrons are in here, and they're confined into the sample at the edges. You know, we sort of cut off the sample at the edges, and so there's some sort of electric field holding the electrons into that, what's known as a Hall bar. Okay? So there's magnetic field perpendicular to the plane of the sample. And since we have crossed electric and magnetic fields, we'll have, there'll be a Lorentz force, and on particles, charged particles, will try to go in perpendicular directions like this, okay? These are known as quantum Hall edge states. The current likes to flow along the edge of the sample in opposing directions. Everyone good? Happy? All right. So now one can change the shape of the sample a little bit. Look like this. So this is all on the top fluid, and then it's vacuum outside. And so the edge states snake along the edge like this. Okay? Now if these edges come close enough to each other, a quasiparticle running along the edge can occasionally scatter across this gap here and go back this way. So it can make some sort of backscattering event like that. And you can measure this in experiment because it shows up as resistance when you try to measure the resistance of the sample. All right. So the actual experiment that people are trying to do, and this experiment, or versions of it, have been proposed by a number of groups. A version of it was just described over 10 years ago by a group, Shimon and Wen, and lots of other authors on that paper, then Nyack and Wilczek and Svelik, and then DeSarma and Friedman and Nyack, and then Stern and Halpern, and then Bondersen, Kateyev, and Stengel. So it's a rather popular proposal to do this, and they've all made some contribution to understanding what would go on. So the idea is we now have the same sample but with two pinches. So what you can do, you're sending currents along the edge, you're sending these quasiparticles along the edge, and the quasiparticle can either jump across this gap here and be backscattered here, or it can go on its way and wrap around this larger loop and end up like that. So there's two possible paths, which I'll call short and long. I'll call this tunneling point one and tunneling point two. What we're going to try to do is we're going to try to look at interference between the two possible paths. This is just like a Fabry-Perot interferometer. This thing is a beam splitter here. Part of the beam gets reflected back. The other part of the beam goes around the longer loop, and you're looking for interference between the two of these. So the wave function that ends up being scattered back into this direction, the output wave function here, is going to be some tunneling at point one times the part that took the short path, plus some tunneling at point two times the part that took the long path, and then there's some additional phase, maybe the I-phi, associated with the length of the additional path that the thing took. And you can experimentally actually change that length continuously. So the resistance of the sample that you actually measure, the resistance is going to be the square of this thing in the usual way it is in quantum mechanics, out, which is going to give you something like T1 squared plus T2 squared plus the interesting term, which is the interference term, which is 2 times the real part of T1 star T2 VI phi, and it's short long. So the interference term, which you can pull out experimentally. I mean, the way you see this thing experimentally is by changing the length of the path, and the part that oscillates is the, because phi is changing, is then the interference term. The interference term tells you about this overlap between the short and the long part of the path. So let's try to use our Kaufman invariants to figure out what the overlap between the short and the long part of the path is. So let's draw the same picture again here. We have to start thinking about, we're sending a particle through this interferometer, and we have to think about where that particle came from. Well, the place it's going to come from is you're going to think about having hair created it, so time is going up in this direction now. So hair created at some point in the past, and then I'm going to send it around the interferometer and bring it back to over here. Is that clear what I just drew? Okay. Now, on the other hand, I could, over here, consider the situation where the particle took the long path. So this thing is short. Short equals. So long equals. Again, I'm going to pair create at some earlier time, send it around the long path. So the particle's going to go all the way around this, come back. Okay? So that's long equals. All right? If I want to know what short long overlap is, I just take this guy, turn it upside down, and land it on this. So it looks like this. And then short. And that's just a simple open loop, which has value d. Okay, now if you really hold me to be completely honest, you have to normalize the states, but let's not worry too much about that. Okay. Now I'm going to do exactly the same experiment, but before doing the experiment, I'm going to take a quasiparticle and put it in the center of this loop and examine what's going to happen. So if I do that, again, you have to worry, well, where did this quasiparticle come from? The place it's actually going to come from is we're going to pair create over here at some earlier time and then move the particle into the loop. Okay, so I'm going to change this diagram. Here's I'm going to pair create some particle at an earlier time and then move it into the loop. So now the short wave function has the probe particle and this particle that I put in the experiment before the experiment started. Everyone still with me? More or less? Okay. Over here, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to pair create the particle and move this guy in. So I'm going to pair create over here. But he goes through here because he's sitting there before this guy goes around him. Okay? So this is long now. Now, in the case where the quasi-particle is sitting in the center, I then have the situation, if I take short and turn it upside down and put it on long, I have, what does it look like? Well, long is on the bottom, so it looks like this. And this guy goes through like this. This guy comes around like that. Okay, that's long on the bottom. And then short on the top, this guy goes like this. And then this guy closes up like that. Okay? So this is two link loops, or what they call the hop link. Let's see, it goes under like this and over like that and closes up like that. Everyone happy? All right. So in order to figure out what the amplitude of this interference term is, we have to figure out what is the Kaufman invariant of this so-called hop link. All right. So let's do that way over here. Oh, there he is, the hop link. For a second, I think. Okay. So here we go. In the stunning conclusion, hold your breath here. All right, so there's the link we're trying to evaluate, and we're going to use this rule twice. Yeah, this rule twice. So the first time we use it, we're going to look at this guy up here. It gives me A times this, and it goes under, over like that. Plus A inverse times something that looks like this.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why do you let it go in front or back? What does that mean?
In front or in back?
Well, say when it crosses the loop. So this fluid is going in back on the bottom part.
Yeah.
And in front.
So you have to think about this is a 2+1 dimensional diagram. So this is actually living. You know, you have to think about there's a particle that's sitting here, and the interferometer is living here in the plane, and the long path actually went around that. So it goes in that direction. So, okay. Then we have to just a couple more things here. So we apply the Kaufman rule down here. And down here is going to give me A squared times something that looks like this, plus something that looks now like this, plus something that looks now like this, plus A minus 2 times 2 open loops, and that guy. So put together some terms. This is D squared, this is D, this is D, this is D squared, and it ends up being minus D cubed plus 2D. Okay, good. So that's the final result there. Now, if you look at the result for what D is here, and take the case of k equals 2, which is corresponds presumably to nu equals 5 half fractional quantum Hall state, then D for k equals 2, in this case, D is square root 2. Plug that in over here, and for k equals 2, this thing gives you 0, which I've now drawn with a slash through it so it's not confused with this. So what's that mean? What that means is that there's no interference term when there's a single quasi-particle inside the loop, which is rather remarkable. And it turns out, so you have the full interference term. Remember, we calculated that first. It came up non-zero. You have the interference term when there's no quasi-particle in the loop. When you put a quasi-particle in the loop, the interference disappears. And if you do this more carefully, you'll discover when you put two quasi-particles inside the loop, the interference comes back. And with three, it disappears again. And that's what people are trying to see. Whether there's an oscillation as you add number of quasi-particles to the middle of the loop, whether you see and then don't see the interference term. And it may be slightly too early to say that this has now been seen, but there's recent data which seems to indicate that this has now been seen. So what does that mean? What that means, if it's true, and there's an awful lot of caveats that go with it, but if it's true, that means that nu equals 5 halves really is a topological quantum field theory. It really is a topological phase of matter. That means this type of system where only topology matters and not geometry really does exist. And it really opens the door for us to make these things useful. We change from the realm of physics to the realm of engineering. We know these things exist. We're just trying to build something with it now. So with a lot of caveats and fears for the future, this is going to be extremely difficult. But that's the aim of what these people are trying to do. And I'll stop there and take any questions of people.
Questions? Anybody? You gave this intuitive explanation why this topological quantum field is really useful for different computing. But in terms of like the energy gap that you have in this system for the excitations, what value?
Yeah, okay, so that's a good question. Fractional quantum Hall effect, when I say you have to cool it down to low temperature before it condenses into a fractional quantum Hall state, that's the question of the energy gap. For the 5 half state, the energy gap is on the order of a Kelvin. And for the 12/5 state, and one thing I didn't tell you is that the 5 half state is really not that good for quantum computing, whereas the 12/5 state is. So the energy gap here is about a tenth of a Kelvin. So you have to be well below that energy gap. Otherwise, there'll be quasi-particle excitations spontaneously generating everywhere, and that can cause you trouble. So yeah, if someone's going to build one of these quantum computers, it's probably going to be cooled down to the 5 millikelvin range or even colder. So, it's hard. It's saying this isn't going to be easy.
But if the picture for the old piece, well, this one is the same as for...
The picture is the same. The, it's a different value of k. As far as this particular experiment goes, what you find is that neither of the two amplitudes are zero. One of the amplitude is one value, another of the amplitude is another value, and there's not a direct relationship between even and odd, but you'll discover that there are two amplitudes which you can measure which differ by a factor of, in terms of the golden mean. You'll have high amplitude and low amplitude as you change what's going on in the center. So, so it's similar, but actually people are studying this much less actively, mainly because it's much harder because you have to be at much lower temperature to do it. It's much more finicky. It requires higher mobility samples, less disorder. Anything, you whisper at it and it disappears. So it's you have to.
So a couple of related questions. What chemical compound is the 12/5 state? Is it the same as the 5 half state?
It's still two-dimensional electrons. Still two-dimensional electrons in a magnetic field, fractional quantum Hall effect.
Okay. But it's also works for the same chemical compounds as the...
Yeah, so these are left... Okay, so there's proposals that there'll be SU2 level 2 for these two chemical compounds, which are actually materials. The evidence for it is not as good. There's lots of questions about what's actually going on in those physical systems, but it could be that those are a good route to be studying these things. Unfortunately, they live in the SU2 level 2 world, and that's less good for quantum computing than this guy, which is much better for quantum computing, even though the energy cap is much lower.
So from a practical point of view, are there ideas for how you predict which compounds are going to be good for...
No.
It's kind of like superconductors then?
Yeah.
It's like, and then they find out later.
So
are there any other not invariants that would be sort of...
There's a whole world of topological quantum field theories, and each one of them corresponds to some not invariant. The question is whether you can find a physical system which corresponds to that particular not invariant. I don't believe that... With the exception of small modifications to the sort of SU2 level K, no physical system is known to actually exist which has these not invariants as a property. However, there are sort of idealized models you could write down, Hamiltonians, whose properties should correspond to other other non-invariants. But you know, there's no physical system which corresponds to them yet.
We have level line duality in this thing?
Yeah, okay, so you can think of, okay, so there are minor modifications when you do level rank duality, but to a large extent, SU2 level 3 and SU3 level 2 will have similar properties. Yeah.
You won't be able to distinguish between them?
Yeah, I'm not sure how you would be able to distinguish them or not. I think you probably can, although the experiments do them would probably be impossible. But it would probably, I think it probably shows up in the spin factors. You know offhand. Yeah. So.
Any other questions? Well, let's thank Steve again.